overview reminders, let me turn things over to your session facilitator, Jim Rice, to actually start today's broadcast. So Jim, I'm going to call up your materials, and you can feel free to begin whenever you're ready.
Well, thanks, Jean. And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. As Jean mentioned, I'm Jim Rice, and I'll be your session moderator. Boy, it looks like we've got a pretty good crowd here today, including a lot of folks from across the U.S. and several other countries. So we also have a great group of speakers who I'll introduce in just a minute. But first, let me say a few words about ORD's webinar series. So the EPA Office of Research and Development designed this series of webinars to explore some of the key aspects and challenges in working with contaminated sediment sites. For those of you who aren't familiar, ORD is EPA's scientific research arm, and they help inform agency decisions. The research that they do at ORD is driven by the needs of its stakeholders. So the objective of these seminars is to both inform you, the practitioners and stakeholders, about the latest tools and methods that are available, but also to solicit your concerns and understand your research needs around these topic areas that you can see at the top of the page here today. So in light of our interest in getting ready and getting some of your feedback, you've already participated in some icebreaker activities. Now, throughout this webinar, there'll be a series of interactive activities, and we'd really like to get your feedback on these different topics that we pose. So if you haven't already, please go ahead and type in a response or check one of the responses for some of the challenges you face at contaminated sites. You'll see a question like this. And as Jean mentioned, use the blank space at the bottom to enter a word or a phrase, or you can, if you agree with somebody else's entry, you can just press the green square over to the right, and that will register your response also. So it looks like we have quite a few responses here, and it looks like we all face a number of the same challenges at these contaminated sediment sites. So some of the different challenges that we seem to face are the fact that these are very large, diffuse areas. They're very active. They're dynamic conditions. They're also multiple source areas, and they're difficult to control. It's hard to figure out how to do some of these remediations. And oftentimes, these remediations have much higher costs. And ultimately, there are resources that are very unique to these environments that we have to try to protect and understand as we move forward towards assessment and mitigation. So how do we address these? Given these challenges, we need to find some really effective ways to address these contaminated sediments all throughout the project life cycle. So our CSMs have to be based on really good site characterization, and the data has to be robust and good enough to build a strong framework for defining risk and mitigation strategies. We have to collect and apply current and relevant data to inform the risk effect assessments and help define effective cleanup goals just based on that data. And finally, we need to ensure that the remedies that we're using are addressing the site risks through appropriate and efficient monitoring throughout the project life cycle. So over the talks is going to bring together a lot of experts to explore the latest thinking in all of these areas up above. Your job as participants is to listen, digest, and respond to that information and give us your feedback so that we can turn that into some research areas. So today, our topic is going to be site characterization. Proper site characterization of contaminated sediments is really crucial to the success of any future action that we want to take at the site. Today's speakers are going to talk about some of the tools that we can use for developing a CSM using modeling. And then we're going to talk about a couple of different specific sampling methodologies that collect data to build and refine a good solid CSM. So our first presentation is from a team of sediment modeling experts from the Corps of Engineers Engineer Research and Development Center. And they're going to help us understand the range of models that are available to support contaminated sediments and studies throughout the project life cycle. Together, this team has over 100 years of experience working with sediment sites around the world. Our panel of experts from the Corps includes Todd Bridges, Paul Schroeder, Earl Hader, Don Hayes, and Joe Gailani. So next, we'll move from the planning phase to the implementation phase of site characterization, where Matt Neal and Marvin Heskett will tell us about the application of incremental sampling to sediment sites. And they'll talk about some of the equipment and planning necessary to implement an effective incremental sampling strategy. Matt's a geologist and field manager with Element Environmental, and he specializes in site characterization in some of the more challenging, logistically challenging areas around the Pacific. Marvin's also from Element Environmental and specializes in chemistry and data quality issues related to characterization. And our final speaker for this afternoon will be Dr. Rainer Lohmann, a professor of oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. Dr. Lohmann's done extensive work in the area of monitoring programs and monitoring techniques with more than 100 peer-reviewed journal articles. Today, he'll discuss the uses and limitations of passive sampling devices for measuring organic contaminants in water. So, we encourage you to actively participate in these discussions and respond to the various poll questions and pose your own questions as you see throughout the session. Now I'd like to turn the presentation over to our first speakers from the Corps of Engineers Engineer Research and Development Center. And I believe Earl Hader will be doing the presentation, or at least kick us off. Are you on, Earl?
Well, Jim, this is Todd Bridges. I'll be starting, but we appreciate the opportunity to be here and to contribute to this important topic. Modeling for contaminated sediment sites is a very big topic. We've collected together across the experience range represented by the authors of this presentation about 10 minutes worth of overview. It would be very easy to spend 10 hours on this topic, probably could spend 10 days on it, but we've basically collected some thoughts relevant to this important topic here. There are a range of physical environments and conditions that are operating at contaminated sediment sites, as well as the dynamics that are associated with the physical processes, which combine to present a lot of the complexity that we're challenged with as we try to manage risks related to contaminated sediments. In respect to modeling as a way of characterizing sites, one question, if I can paraphrase Shakespeare for a moment, that has been posed from time to time is to model or not to model. That is the question. At times you will hear people express the idea that they really want to make decisions based on data rather than models, expressing a measure of discomfort or a lack of confidence in modeling. But I think we would suggest respectfully that question should be probably set aside. It's not whether to model, it's really how to model at appropriate scales and levels of effort, and we'll get into that question more. The other issue I think I might present by way of introduction is a condition that we have seen at a number of sites, and those who contributed to developing this presentation have literally worked on hundreds of contaminated sediments over our careers, and it's the unfortunate condition where we have kind of dueling models operating at sites where we may have PRPs and those representing the government doing different kinds of modeling with different kinds of models and then trying to reconcile those. And I think one of the opportunities that we have in the future is how we might be able to approach this in a more efficient, more collaborative manner going forward. Models are a way of understanding data, in fact, of converting data into actual information. I think that's one of the most important uses of modeling that we can actually present. There are a range of questions, in fact, that can motivate modeling or drive modeling, and you see a list of these questions here as just a subset of the questions that are relevant to site characterization and to projects relevant to contaminated sediments generally. And I'm not going to read these. Those participating in our webinar can do so. But the idea is that we have a number of reasons why we engage in modeling. And in fact, modeling as an activity, an important activity for contaminated sediment projects, really encompasses the full life cycle of such a project, including remedial investigation and feasibility study portions, as well as the implementation of actual remedies and the monitoring that follows. Data and the use of data and information and developing modeling frameworks, if you will, that allow us to understand what the data mean and how to use the information that we derive from data is critical at all stages of a contaminated sediment project. So with this brief introduction, I'm going to transition now to my colleague, Joe Galani, who's going to present the next few slides of our presentation.
Okay, thank you. I am not, I presently do not have control of the slides. So if we can move to the next slide, what level of analysis is required? I'll just start speaking, and what we're talking about here is the level of analysis is the degree of quantitative analysis that has to be performed on the data to address the questions that you're trying to answer. It might be what the response of the system will be to various remediation options. For smaller scale sites, possibly it's easy to extrapolate the data that already exists without the use of any type of a modeling framework in which to structure the data and predict what the system is going to do in the future. But those sites are generally rare due to the complexity of sites. Sites are homogeneous. The contamination may vary spatially and temporally, as well as the sediment types, the hydraulics conditions, etc. And the limited modeling efforts may be needed to structure those data and identify the heterogeneity and how various subregions within the location will respond under various remediation alternatives. Generally, simpler models are used to address a narrow range of questions to make the technically sound decisions. Next slide, please. However, many sites have highly variable sediment properties, contaminant concentrations, as well as hydrologic and hydrodynamic processes. There may be quiescent areas and more energetic areas within the system. In these heterogeneous systems, we will probably need more advanced tools, numerical models, to frame these data and evaluate remediation alternatives and how we expect the system to respond under various alternatives in the long term. These models can also help us decide what data to collect and other important factors. So numerical models that predict long-term future response of a system will likely be needed when you're managing sediments in place, where groundwater discharges are considerable, where you have continuing sources and background contamination, and or the sediments are dynamic, i.e. the hydrodynamic conditions may move them around. Next slide, please. Okay, if we could just collect to the next slide. And yes, thank you. There is a common statement that all models are wrong, but some are useful. This really got its introduction in 1979 in a chapter on the robustness of scientific model building in the report that is identified here in the academic press, and you can find that online in Google Scholar. And it's really a good chapter on the models, and if all modeling is wrong, it's really an acknowledgement that models are a gross simplification of the geophysical, the chemical, and the biological processes that occur in systems. Not only is the representation a simplification, but everything has to be discretized, whether you treat the entire site as one box in the model or you have 100 cells within the model that have various levels of hydrologic process, hydrodynamic processes, contaminant concentrations, or sediment types. There's still a gross simplification. They're both discretized and a simplification of the actual process. However, some models can adequately represent the evolution of a system such that these models can be used to compare alternatives and identify proper management of a site. However, as important as the model is the modeler. The modeler has to understand not only the system that you're working on, but how the model represents the processes in that system. Only then can the modeler determine how to use the model for the purposes which you have identified. For example, comparing risk reduction under various remediation alternatives. Now I'm going to identify in the next slide what the models may be used for. So the use of models, the model actually can tell you things about where you need to collect the data, where the vulnerable locations are, where there are still gaps, where systems are dynamic. You can perform hypothesis testing using the numerical models and use it to refine the conceptual site model and then test that refined model. And this way, you develop a more robust understanding of the system and a more robust numerical model representation of the system. The model is often used as a prognostic tool for predicting the future behavior of the system. Specifically, this is where we can look at remediation alternatives and determine which will achieve the objective of the cleanup goal, the management goal. So it's used to evaluate the various options and then support the remedy design. It can also help a manager understand how the site should be monitored, where things are most likely to occur, where, for example, there may be re-exposure of sediments, and where to focus your limited monitoring dollars. So with that, to continue on, I'm going to hand it over to Earl.
Okay, I'm Earl Hayter, and the next three slides, we have compiled a list of you might call it the top 10 list of modeling-related issues that we have encountered over the past multiple decades in the use of models, not only in selecting models to use, but then applying them, you know, at many different contaminated sediment sites. So here we're starting at the top. We're starting at number one. We're not starting at number 10 and going to one. We're starting at one, and these are somewhat prioritized in terms of their importance. But if you have decided through your analysis that modeling is needed at your particular site, then the selection of which model to use is extremely critical. And again, as it says there, use models. It's recommended that models be used that have been used at other sites. It's highly recommended that proprietary codes not be used, and that's also included in the 2006 Contaminated Sediment Guidance document published by EPA, and also a collaborative approach to model development and use between EPA modelers and the PRP modeling team is definitely preferred or recommended. So just like selecting which model should be used at the site is critical, selection of the modeling team is also very, very important. And usually at most sites, because of the complexity of the physical and chemical and biological processes operating there, usually you want to select a modeling team that does have extensive experience in similar environments. And again, these list of top 10 are based on our experience where things we've seen go right, where models have been applied, and also where things have gone wrong because maybe, you know, the proper modeling model was not selected or the proper or a very experienced modeling team was not selected. So those two are extremely important, and again, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go through and discuss because there's really no time to do it, all 10. I'm going to move on to the next slide now and go down to the points and briefly hit on points 5 and 6. Again, the modeling team that's been selected hopefully is a very experienced team, and they need to be very familiar with how the model or models that's going to be applied represent, again, these geochemical physical processes that control the extent of contamination and its possible transport and fate. So again, you know, experience in just running a model is not sufficient. The modeler must be familiar with how the model represents each of these processes. Because going right into point number 6, if necessary, the modeling team should be able to modify one or more of the subroutines in your model to represent site-specific conditions. So again, they have to be familiar with the programming language of the model, but again, also be familiar with how each model is representing all these different processes to be able to make, you know, sufficient or appropriate changes to the code, if necessary, to, again, to better represent site-specific conditions. But again, they also must be able to validate the modified code. So again, you want to make sure if changes are made that you do have, you do test that thoroughly before you proceed. And then going to the last slide, the last four of the top 10 list, again, number 7 I think is very, very important. Now, all of these are, but modelers should be part of the team evaluating the alternatives and familiar with the outcomes required for the decision making. I myself have been involved at sediment sites where, as part of the modeling team, we are given scenarios that we need to model without any background information, or in other words, we weren't part of the decision-making process to add possible, you know, input in deciding which type of scenarios could really realistically be modeled and which could not. Some processes we really cannot model very well at all, and if you do, the uncertainty is going to be very, very big. And then lastly, again, number 8, never be satisfied with one answer. Remember, as everybody has heard the expression, you know, a model or models is just one line of evidence. But you should never be satisfied, as this bullet is saying, never be satisfied with one answer. I mean, you definitely need to perform sensitivity and even bracketing to try to at least semi-quantify the uncertainty associated with the model results. Now, because of time, I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is just give the photo of the cover of a report that I highly recommend for anybody who is going to be using models at their site or thinking about using models. Again, this is published, as you see, by the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation, published back in 2009, Understanding the Use of Models and Predicting the Effectiveness of Proposed Remedial Actions at Superfund Sediment Sites. So a very valuable reference that you can get directly from Superfund Sites' webpage. And with that, I'm going to go to the very last slide, and we finally do have a photo, and that's just to throw out, and this is actually at New Bedford Harbor, Massachusetts. This is the entrance to New Bedford Harbor, and just a very short reach of the hurricane barrier that crosses the mouth of that harbor. So with that, I'll open it up to any questions.
Well, thanks, team. Feel free to enter some questions, all you participants out there. Just type your question in, and I will try to bring them up. So first question that we've posed is, you know, item number 6 suggested that we use, or you use, open source code models. So why is it important to use these open source models?
Well, it's important because so that if necessary, the model can be modified by the modeling team during the, you know, application of that model. If you're just using a proprietary model, you know, the modeling team, unless you contract to the developer of that model, you know, the modeling team will not be able to make any changes to the model at all. So that's one of the main reasons, is just so that it's, you know, you can make modifications, but also because of the fact that if it's an open source model, that means it's probably been applied at multiple locations, not only in this country, but worldwide possibly. So by that multiple applications, by multiple modeling teams, again, models begin to get, different modeling teams begin to get familiar with models and may even make suggestions to changes in the models. But because it's open, people can go in there, look at the code, and again, make modifications if necessary. Joe, you want to add anything to that?
I'll add. I mean, this is Todd Bridges. I'll add some just to say that, you know, sometimes some of the criticisms you might hear about modeling is that it's being approached as a so-called black box exercise. And part of that issue is what Earl was just addressing. If you don't know what's going on inside the box, you're not really in a position to use adequately the modeling in the context of a project. This should never be, the application of modeling should never be, if you will, a black box exercise in any contaminated sediment project. And having open source access to the code is one way of avoiding that problem.
All right. Well, we have time for one other question. I have a quick question. Obviously, you deal with an awful lot of different models that can be applied at different stages throughout the project lifecycle. Can you give us some suggestions or your experience? What's the most common model used, and what are kind of the critical data that go into and come out of that model?
I don't think there are certainly models when you get to the, there are only a few models when you get to the most complex levels of modeling, where you're modeling the groundwater and the circulation and dynamics of the system. There are really a few that are used frequently. But generally, you want to start basic with the more basic models and work your way to the more complex model. Each stage will tell you what level of model, and to the modeler at least, what the appropriate models are for the application. I'm not sure if naming names is appropriate for models at this point, but it's generally an evolving process.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll come back to that one later on if folks have additional questions.
Okay.
So right now I'd like to move to our second speaker of the afternoon, and that's a team from Element Environmental. It's going to be Matt Neal and Marvin Heskett, and they're going to talk about incremental sampling at sediment sites. Matt and Marvin, are you on the line?
Yes, thanks, Jim. So, yeah, right. I'm Matt Neal. I'm here with Marvin Heskett. We work with Element Environmental, as Jim said. And today we're going to talk about ISM sediment sampling strategies and techniques, and also known as multi-increment sampling. This is something we've been doing out here. Our Department of Health in Hawaii has been a big proponent of ISM, or multi-increment sampling, for well over 10 years. So we've had experience doing this for over 10 years in both soil and sediment. So these sediment just more recently. So we wanted to share with everyone what we've learned so far and how we're developing our techniques. I'm going to pass this over to Marvin now. He's going to go over some general ISM or multi-increment strategies and concepts for those of you. We know we have a wide range in the audience out there, so we want to get a good base for gathering an understanding for ISM sampling. So, Marvin.
Yeah, hello. My name is Marvin Heskett. I'd like to start off by going over just the theory and the background of what ISM is for those who haven't learn anything about the concept yet. And if, for those of you that have, maybe just kind of frame it in terms of sediment investigations. So basically, incremental sampling is a methodology that offers systematic planning, and it provides a clear framework for the development of environmental investigation objectives. It's a little bit different from other processes in that systematic planning, in terms of you actually, when you're done doing an MIS approach, you're answering a question directly with your data. The key to doing MIS sampling is designing your decision units. We'll go over that in great detail and even have an exercise a little later about what that means. But essentially, a decision unit is an area that of the site that you're interested in seeking information for. And MIS works for just about any effort to determine site use. It's good for characterization, risk assessment, remediation. I don't think we've come across an approach that we felt the MIS wasn't an appropriate method for. It's really the devil's in the details of how you draw your decision unit, whether it's a large scale, information where you want something like a number for a whole harbor, or you want really specific information for something like identifying a source area. So we'll just talk a little bit about how it differs from a traditional site investigation approach using discrete sampling. The simple discrete design, in this example, we're using 30 points to show because we want to compare to how an MIS works. However, we know that most everyone wouldn't use 30 specific discrete samples in determining a source area like this. It would be far more likely to use 4 or perhaps 8. Now, mind you, I know this is not a sediment site example. It's more of a simple conceptual idea, so we can discuss the difference between the approach. So the typical discrete methods are poor at identifying site boundaries. They're high risk of false negatives and false positives. And the potential to consider a single data point or hotspot. They're more expensive, and they're not a good design for estimating risk over an entire exposure area. Another thing to keep in mind is that when you do discrete sampling, what a typical laboratory will do, especially in the case of metals analysis, which is important often in sediments, is the laboratory will extract a single gram of sample from your sample container. It's essentially pulling a sugar cube off your site, which was removed somewhere from your site in a discrete sample. And we're going to draw huge conclusions from that very small amount of information if we follow the discrete approach. Now, when we do ISM or MIS, what we're doing is taking far more samples in general. Like we said, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 samples or more to represent one exposure unit or decision unit area. So you can see you get a much better distribution of information from that site, but then also the laboratory will process the entire MIS sample. It's a little bit hard to describe without going through the details of how the laboratory does it, but they, instead of taking that 1 gram out of a jar, they essentially take the entire sample, which we already did in the field by representing the entire exposure area, and they subsample it in a manner that's statistically correct to represent the entire sample we've provided. Another nice thing you can do with the ISM approach is further delineate your site boundaries for whichever decision you might have. You might want to, for example, break it down into smaller units based on remedial strategies, the number of cubic yards you can haul in a single effort, or perhaps better reduce the area to determine if the source may be coming from one side or the other. And the good thing is that the data can be used for both purposes simultaneously. You can use it to characterize and then potentially have information to use for IDW or disposal. So the original founder of the method, Pierre G, worked out statistics to create a formula for estimating error. And he found that a minimum of 30 to 75 increments sampled using the ISM methods could yield results where site replicates would fall within 30% RSD. As mentioned earlier, the laboratory processes the entire ISM sample as opposed to a single small discrete mass. And now, you know, what we're providing you here is it's an extremely abbreviated look at what ISM is. We highly recommend you follow up with other references and or courses that are offered out there on the subject. The ITRC produced a fairly comprehensive document, and the State of Hawaii Department of Health that Matt mentioned before produces their technical guidance manual, which has a lot more of the detail, the fundamentals, and methods. So I recommend looking into either or both of those.
Okay, so now it looks like we have an activity we wanted. The DU, or the decision unit, is the crux of ISM sampling. It's extremely important that you design your sampling plan, your DUs, in order to gather data that you need for your specific DQOs or your data quality objectives for the project that you're completing. So what we provide here is a sample site. It's actually one of our sites that we've done previously. We show just an aerial view, and you can see this is a stream. We have the ocean, the stream outfalls to the Pacific Ocean here. It's about a half a mile or so long. The project involved maintenance dredging. So we want you guys. What we did is we determined these DUs in the second photo down here based on several factors. We based this on sediment volume to be dredged during the maintenance dredging. Position DUs based on ag use over here, a former landfill, upstream potential activities, an industrial site over here. So you can see we've tailored these DUs to capture their different shapes and sizes based on those factors. So what we want you guys to do, similar to placing discrete samples, to take a crack at placing DUs on a site. And then we can explain why certain methods might be better than others. So here's a sample site we've chosen. This is on the island of Kauai. It's also a former project site of ours. But this is about 130-acre or so harbor. We have a stream input here. We have some industrial activities along the harbor front and our harbor mouth out here. So in determining decision units, typically with a discrete sample plan, you may have, say, three or four, if you're just trying to characterize or screen this, you may have one at the river mouth, one along the adjacent to the shoreline, near the industrial activity over here, and then maybe one at the harbor mouth to see to do some sort of delineation. So if we were to make this one single DU, at the minimum we'd have 30 boring locations or coring locations in this 130 acres rather than maybe a lesser discrete amount, maybe two or three or a handful. But there are other options for laying out DUs. So what we've done is we've predetermined several options. We have in this shape, we've thrown in some different DU design alternatives to look at and think about possibly for different scenarios. So here's option A. We can see we've broken it up into four or five decision units, kind of a general layout. Option B, more focused on maybe shoreline activities and upstream potential sources of contamination. And then a more comprehensive layout. So what we'd like you folks to do is think about your sampling plans. Maybe you have ISM experience, maybe you don't, but even with discrete sampling, think about how you'd like to position your decision units on a site like this. And we understand it'll vary greatly, but we've given you options A, B, and C. And then, you know, why would you choose a certain pattern over another? I see you guys, some people are already answering. Looks like A or B and C are getting the most hits here, which would make sense for us. You know, none of these are wrong, first off. Depends on what your project goals are. However, we feel in this instance, if you have options B or C, they would offer a more comprehensive view and a better way to isolate potential hotspots.
I always noticed that someone has typed in that C would be too expensive, and that's a really good observation that, you know, the cost is certainly something that you want to consider when you're planning your DUs. However, we're going to also talk a little bit about cost and cost savings of doing a more appropriate site characterization that, you know, we found that we often come out 10 times less cost at the end of a large, especially dredging activity, if you actually spend the time up front to characterize correctly.
That's right. Like Marvin said, what we've found in our experience is that the downhill costs, you know, once we may spend more up front in planning these DUs and collecting samples, but, you know, the savings are tenfold or more when you're trying to actually excavate or dredge and dispose of this stuff down the line, and the savings you can have with volume. In a harbor like this, if you were to dredge, you know, 100 acres, you know, it's a sizable amount of volume, and the cost can add up. So some upfront savings or more sampling can really make a big difference on your remediation costs. And basically, what we've seen on the land side on similar sites and using MI sampling or ISM sampling is that you can vastly save on volume of sediment or soil that is not contaminated being disposed of as if it is contaminated due to lack of representative sampling.
You know, I just wanted to say, someone wrote in there a D, why not more DUs? That's a great observation. Of course, there's, you know, room for other designs. And I think one thing that, you know, Matt mentioned is that none of these are wrong. It kind of just depends on your data quality objective. If you wanted to screen for background contamination, see if it's there at all, you know, something like A or even less is definitely appropriate. So I'm reading a lot of these comments coming in, and I'm hearing that there are, you know, that's what people are looking at. They're kind of thinking about how they would approach it based on data quality objectives that they would consider for that, for whatever it is that they're doing.
So, yeah, thank you. We're getting some good comments here. I wish we could take the time to read all of them. But let's move on. There we go. So we've just had some brief explanations of why you would want to have, you know, we chose option C for more DUs, and we have some reasons why. You know, that you want your DU to capture the river inlet. It is a potential source contributor, so maybe you establish DUs from upstream to downstream that would help isolate or characterize any contamination from that source. The same will look along the shoreline. We would position DUs based on the adjacent industrial activities, maybe contributors or outfalls, or things that may contribute to the nearshore sediment there. And then as you get out to the harbor mouth, you're looking for delineation or finding an end to your contamination. So we've established DUs to achieve that. And like we've seen in the comments, there could be any number of different patterns and ways depending on the specific site contributors or goals. Anyway, I hope that's what we go through. That's an abbreviated process of what we would go through during the work plan or sampling analysis plan phase for any ISM sediment sampling project. Okay, so as with discrete sampling, sediment sampling offers some challenging planning. Basically, it's a dynamic environment, as we've heard from previous speakers, and as most of you know. The sediment type thing, key factors in determining the ISM sediment sample collection methods, sediment type, number one, is it silt, is it clay, is it sand? You have large grain size. The water depth and movement, you know, are you in a harbor, a river, the open ocean? And that would in turn determine your sample platform. These are all logistical type things that really have a big impact on your efficiency and the data quality. And then again, your data goals, as we just discussed. Your DU establishment is very important. If you're characterizing for dredge, maintenance dredging, you know, you would have different DUs, maybe vertical DUs, as opposed to if you're characterizing just for contamination characterization. So those would all go into play in determining your sampling plan. Establishment of the DUs, again, is key. So typical, this is kind of a photo of an example of typical sediment sampling setup with a VibroCore. You know, you have a pretty large vessel. You have large equipment. You know, the VibroCore can weigh a couple hundred pounds. The up and down of each sediment core takes a while. It's a big process. So basically, for ISM sampling, we have to go up and down a lot. If we wanted to collect 30 samples or 30 cores where we would normally collect one or two or three, we need to downsize. You know, the traditional large equipment just isn't practical for a lot of ISM sampling locations. It wouldn't be economical, take too long. So we've been working over the past several years to optimize our equipment, our methods, tailor to each site, and try to become more efficient. The good thing about ISM sampling is it doesn't, as opposed to the standard, you know, get on a location and collect a core or two and then find another GPS coordinate that's been predetermined maybe in the sampling analysis plan phase, is that ISM is randomly chosen cores within a decision unit. As long as you have defined your decision unit boundaries, you can collect your 30, 50, 75, whatever the number of increments are within that decision unit randomly. So you want to get good spatial coverage, but you don't have to be exactly on a point. And we spent days trying to anchor on a specific GPS coordinate or lock down something based on the sampling plan. So there's one positive in collecting more random samples is that we don't have to spend time doing that. So we're going to go over a couple recent sample projects. We've conducted ISM sediment sampling around the greater Pacific area, including, you know, Hawaii, the outer islands of Hawaii, the Okinawa, Japan, you know, Micronesia. We've collected ISM samples on different projects around there over the last, you know, 5 or 6, 7, 8 years. So we've chosen three of these to go over quickly with you guys. The first case study is a canal or stream located in Honolulu. The purpose of this is maintenance dredging. We were able to find a source area here. There was an old incinerator, a garbage incinerator here. So we positioned one to center DU to encapsulate any outfalls or surface water runoff that may have occurred from that source. And then we established the other DUs based on, this was a minimal, more of a screening level. So the client wanted to do minimal samples, but again, wanted to be somewhat representative of what we were going to find. So we established three DUs. We collected 150 increments or cores. It was relatively shallow, so we were able to do most of it with hand cores or push cores. You can see them in the photos there. It took 2 days to do 150 cores, which we've been trying to find efficient ways to do this. So this was one site we were able to do it just by hand.
And, you know, one thing to keep in mind when you're doing MIS samples, if you're within the same decision unit, you don't have to decon your equipment necessarily between each drive. So that's one way you can really increase your resolution and do it efficiently, as opposed to having to pull up your equipment, which a lot of times this stuff is fairly complex and hard to decontaminate. You can avoid that step as long as you haven't moved on into your next decision unit.
So anyway, the RSD that you see there, 24%. So RSD, the relative standard deviation, is a QAQC method that's used for ISM sampling. It shows the level of comparability between samples. So in other words, in one of these DUs, you see the center DU with the multi colors here. We collected not only 30, we collected 90. So three separate ISM samples consisting of 30 cores each. And RSD between those three was a 24%. Typically, and our Department of Health here in their guidance, anything 35% or less shows a good correlation between samples. Here's another study. It's a stream on Oahu, the North Shore. This was another maintenance dredging project. There were heavy sediment deposits. You can see in this figure in the middle, this topography survey figure, the green, you know, the top of the map is the ocean side, and then the bottom is upstream. So you can see the green colors are shallow sediment, or the dredge depth is shallower, meaning the water is deeper. The darker areas, the red, black, brown, are the more depositional areas where deeper cores were necessary and more dredging was to occur. So we based our decision units on sediment depth and on the information from this survey, this topography survey, bathymetric survey. So we established the DUs, and then during the course of the sampling, some of the cores were up to 10 feet long. So we had to fashion a mini vibracore, essentially, using a concrete vibrator and an aluminum tube. And it worked fairly well. We were able to get down to our dredge depths and collect representative samples. But we did have to, one note on this, we had to do collect vertical decision units. In other words, different sediment types. We had silt, we had an organic flock on top, we had a silt and then a sand, and the client in this case wanted to be able to reuse whatever sediment they could based on suitability. So they wanted to use the sand for beach replenishment, the silt for agriculture use. So we were able to differentiate between those layers during the sampling and collect separate vertical views to achieve the goals here. Again, we got an RSD of 30%. So the last stream here was the same picture as in the exercise. Again, it was a maintenance dredging project. We tailored the DUs towards sources and volume. You can see here, one note, we've been messing around with all sorts of techniques depending on the job and the sediment depth and everything. This was really shallow. We were able to form a mini vibracore out of a car buffer that we bought at Napa just to assist in getting down to our dredge depth. You can see in the plastic tube, that's our method of choice for collection, because we can see the sediment. We can see if we've collected undisturbed fines on top, which are typically of concern with contamination. So as we go along here, and I'm sorry I keep, where we've been evolving our method, we've been using this, recently we have a mini vibracore that is being produced now in Texas. This has just come out this year, and we're no longer having to use car buffers and things. So this is great. We can easily deploy it. There's no need for a super large boat. We can do it off the shore, off a skiff, or off a dock. You can easily lift it, no need for a crane. Sensitive arrow here. These are just photos of what the core looks like when it comes up in the acetate. You can see here in the green arrow our sediment core. This is where we look at it, do our characterization, possibly choose our vertical DUs if we see a variance in sediment types. This bottom is a picture of the boat and from underwater, and us deploying our sediment sampler in a deeper water application. So the overall takeaways for so far in our experience with ISM sediment sampling is it can be labor intensive, more so than if you would compare it to, say, collecting 3 discrete samples or 90, 3 times 30, 90 cores for 3 ISM samples. It requires flexibility, adaptability of collection methods. Obviously, we've tried many different ways. Methods are getting better. We're gaining more experience in-house, so we're feeling more comfortable about applying different ways to collect sediment, as well as folks around in the industry. I think the overall takeaway is that what we found, the overall cost may be slightly higher if we would do a similar discrete method. However, that seems to be outweighed by if you were to actually sample, collect discrete samples in the same manner or same resolution as we do our IM samples, then it would be more expensive. You have to pay for additional lab costs of each discrete sample, and the data, we've found superior data with our ISM samples as far as determining risk, characterizing for construction, dredging, disposal. And Marvin, do you have anything to add?
Well, no, I think I'll save mine for maybe answering folks' questions if they have any after finishing.
Yeah, so we had quite a few questions come up. Unfortunately, we're out of time for your presentation right now. What we're showing is a video, a clip of deploying one of the sediment samplers. If you want to just take a minute and explain that, and then we'll move right on to the next speaker.
Sure. This is just an application of the mini VibraCore. You can actually lower it on a cable. The vibration unit and weights are attached to it. Then with floats, it's kept oriented correctly, so you can send it down into deeper depths than what a pole would allow. You turn the unit on and run it remotely using a cable device, and then you collect the sample from depth and retrieve it back to the boat. We're fortunate to have some good visibility at this location off Maui, but you can see how well it works. It took two of us 10 minutes to successfully collect a one-foot sample at a depth of about 40 feet. In this case, we hit refusal at about a foot, and that's consistent with the bottom here. So, you know, it would have been nice to show it going deeper. We are capable of going deeper at other locations. They just didn't have the same type of visibility for the demonstration.
All right. Well, thanks very much. So we will have some time at the end, and we'll try to get to some of the many questions. There's a lot of great questions on ISM methodology, some of the details as well as some of the bigger picture understanding of DUs and setting up DUs as opposed to discrete samples. So our final speaker for this afternoon is Rainer Lohmann, and Rainer will be speaking about passive samplers and how passive samplers can give us a good understanding of pore water and some of the limitations. So Rainer, are you ready?
Absolutely.
Great.
So we start off with a question to get an impression of how familiar people are with the passive sampling. And it looks like we have a mix of very experienced professionals and some who've never used them, and some who claim to not know what they are. So that is perfect. So let me go ahead. I'll talk about passive sampling of particularly pore water sediment concentration and some of the limitations that exist with that approach. So to make this very simple, a passive sampler is a tool that we can use to measure the activity of pollutants in the field. In this particular case, of course, we focus on the pore water that within the sediment. Passive sampler works through diffusion, which also means that it is somewhat on the slow side because the molecules have to be able to diffuse. But when I said activity, I really mean that only those contaminants that are mobile and can diffuse, we can measure. We cannot take up any of the contaminants that are bound to particles or colloids because they cannot diffuse into the passive sampler itself. So that's an important distinction, that we really measure what is available. Of course, there's something we need to know about passive sampling, that is the partitioning coefficients, the K passive water, so how we translate the concentration in the passive sampler to the dissolved concentration surrounding it. And we have to have some ways of determining whether the compounds in the passive sampler have reached equilibrium. We do that typically through adding performance reference compounds, maybe through a time series, or some other such approach to verifying equilibrium has been reached. So what are passive samplers best used for? And the widest range of literature and application has really been for hydrophobic organic contaminants. And as I said, mostly this is, of course, for sediment pore water, but you can use the same passive sampling approach to also measure these compounds in the water column itself. If you're interested in the release from contaminated sediments to the water column, you can do that. You can do it in the air for gas-based compounds particularly. And there are some nifty applications where they're actually used in biota, inserted into tissue or fish, for example. In terms of hydrophobic organic contaminants, we're really talking about the classical legacy contaminants, dioxins, PCBs, PAHs, some flame retardants, and a lot of the old pesticides. That's what the typical passive sampler are best suited for. Note that, of course, science is underway to look at passive sampling for methylmercury, and I think some of the future webinars will feature one of those. And for PFAS and other polar organic chemicals, work is underway to have the tools ready for those too. There's the picture here from Hugh Jonkers on the right-hand side of your screen. And it shows the three most commonly used passive samplers that are in use right now. And magically, perfect, my cursor appeared. So there's polyethylene sheets. They're often used because they're chemically very simple. They're very cheap. They can be cut to any size you wish. There's also PDMS or silicone sheets that are also can be used. And then there's a wide range of fibers, SPME fibers, often coated with silicone. And those are much thinner and have the benefit, of course, that they're much faster in equilibrating, but also they don't get as many contaminants in the fiber or on the fiber, so the texture limit is somewhat different. Why are these used so much? Because the partitioning coefficients are widely available for polyethylene, silicone, and the SPME fibers, and there are some of the citations down here. So why would we use passive samplers if we are so happy with using our typical grab samples of sediments? And there's a few lines of evidence, and probably the most obvious to everybody who works in the field, is that the total sediment concentration is just not a very useful matrix. I mean, it's easy to measure as you grab your sediment, you extract it, but what that number means is very complicated. And so traditionally, we've used some geochemistry approaches to translate the total sediment concentration to a bioavailable concentration, which then gets propagated into a lipid-based tissue concentration. But it was fairly early on apparent that just looking at organic carbon, so this FOC KOC approach, doesn't really work well. And I've shown one example here from my own work 15 years ago, looking at sediment in New York Harbor and Boston Harbor. Shown is prediction of FOC or KOC. The diagonal line would be the perfect prediction of the measured sediments in the real world, and you see that all of the measured concentration are much different. The partitioning observed is much stronger in the field than we anticipated, so we know FOC KOC doesn't work, and there's plenty of studies to support that. Question is, how do you proceed? One option that Philip Schwent pioneered was to look at organic and black carbon. So now you have to go out to the field, measure the sediment, measure organic and black carbon. But of course, depending on the site, you might have to worry about NAPLs, you might have tar or coal or other particles. So at any given site, you would have to introduce additional terms to make sure the partitioning is correct and the bioavailability you can characterize properly. Of course, another way of doing this whole thing is measuring the pore water concentration directly, which is where the passives come in. And that's really the main benefit. You have the direct measure in the field or in the lab of bioavailability. The other part is that, of course, for these legacy organic pollutants, we're worrying about the accumulation in lipids. And it turns out that the diffusion into a passive sampling membrane is very similar to the diffusion into the lipids of an organism. So there's potential that these passives are actually proxies for bioaccumulation or biomimetic. And so there's an example here from Carrie Friedman's work, where she worked with US EPA in Narragansett. There's concentration of PCBs in the polyethylene here, normalized to the amount of polyethylene. Concentration here is of PCBs in Nereus virens, so a benthic worm. Concentration normalized to lipids, and here you see the comparison. And basically, there's almost perfect one-to-one line suggesting the passive sampler, which was exposed to the same sediment as the worm, gets the same concentration on a weight-normalized basis as does the worm on a lipid. So that's the idea, that you can use a passive as a proxy for bioaccumulation. Of course, there are multiple benefits here. Passive sampler is much cheaper and easier to deploy. It doesn't die in the field. And you can use the same passive sampler across all of your sites, be they freshwater, saline, or whatever the challenge might be. They might be partially dry. The passive will survive. The animals might not always. So, and now, I think what is kind of the latest development in this field of passive sampling is the question, and that's now an open question to the audience, is do you want to have the samples deployed in the field, so the in-situ measurement, or would you rather take the sediment, bring it back to the lab, into the pore water equilibration in the lab, so the ex situ approach. And so there's a chance for you all to weigh in, and I fear this is going to happen. There's a high preference, of course, to have the samplers deployed in the field and get the in situ numbers. And that's certainly where the field is moving, to have samplers that we can deploy, retrieve, and make sense of the numbers. So if I move on to the next, here's a couple of pictures that show the comparison on the left-hand side. I think this is from Loretta Fernandez's work, again with EPA ORD, looking at a polyethylene sheet that is deployed within a aluminum frame, and that was pushed into the sediment through a heavy lander kind of sampling device. And that was on the feed for weeks. On the right-hand side, we see the gloved hand of one of my graduate students, some sediment from, I think, the Newark Bay in New Jersey, and the polyethylene that would now be inserted in the mud. Water will be added, biocide, and will be put on a shake table for several weeks. So, of course, it is strong preference. You want to have the in-situ. The in-situ has a few drawbacks that are, one is logistics. For the in-situ, you have to go out, deploy it, and come back later and retrieve it. So you need two trips, which might be costlier. For the ex-situ, you just have to go out once and grab your sediment. For the in-situ, depending on how you do it, how deep it is, you might need a diver, which could add expense and logistical hassles. For the ex-situ, of course, you just take a sediment grab. That's easy. We talked about the costs. The other part that adds a little bit of challenge to the in-situ approach, of course, that you have to be worried that somebody, that somehow your sampler gets lost during your deployment, that you can't retrieve it because of weather events, of some fisherman crying foul because he or she saw a buoy. So you just have to make sure you find a safe way of securing and locating your sampler after the weeks of exposure. But, of course, you gain with an in-situ approach, you get the real condition of the field that you want to see, whereas if you take it back to the lab, you might have some bias at the results. The heterogeneity really cuts both ways. If it's a very heterogeneous site, as was discussed by the previous speakers, you will just need additional samplers either way if you take it, do it in the field. In the lab, in theory, you could homogenize the sediment, so you might get away with a few less data points. Lastly, the interpretation of the results. So the benefit of the benefit of taking sediments back to the lab is that you can make sure the sampler reaches equilibrium for all your compounds of interest. That makes the interpretation of the data very easy because you just apply partitioning and you're done. In the field, however, because diffusion is slow, you rarely reach that point of equilibrium. So you now have to apply some models to change the results from what you have measured when it was retrieved to a hypothetical equilibrium approach. And so this is basically showing what this looks like. And put the sampler in, the concentration zero, it then starts picking up. And eventually you reach an equilibrium of the contaminant in your passive sampler. And all the ex-situ approaches work here, where the conversion of the results is easy because you just need a partitioning constant. The in-situ, you're somewhere in this range where the uptake is not fully complete, and you have to now just correct for whatever fraction of equilibrium you have not reached yet. So the tool that has been pioneered now for 15, 17 years was the inclusion of performance reference compounds. That's a very powerful approach where you add some non-natural compounds to your samplers before you put them in the field. The reason that they shouldn't occur in nature or at the site is that way you can make sure that there's only diffusion out of the sampler, so you have a loss. And the beauty of the performance reference compounds is that you know their initial concentration, because you put it in yourself, you measure what it is at time zero, and then you watch the disappearance. And this disappearance, the loss, will be affected by the same environmental factors that also affect the uptake of the compound. So if there's if there's big temperature changes, it'll affect both release and uptake. If there's changes in flow, it'll affect both uptake and loss to the same degree. So we have an in-situ control on what's happening. And the idea is if we pick our target compound, might be this green one here. If you take the sampler out after 15 days, it's only 25% equilibrated here. But because we have a matching performance reference compound, we know that it is only 25% equilibrated because the performance reference compound has only been lost to 25%. And that way we can correct to the hypothetical and final equilibrium concentration. So the PSCs become very, very useful and are very powerful for the use of pest sampler in situ. For the correction, there is a number of guidance documents. One of them was the result of work by CERDEP and ESDCP and EPA that was published 2017. It's based on earlier work by Fergus Wendt's group on how to transfer or transform the in situ results to a hypothetical equilibrium concentration, and that really works well for basically any or all CO situation, unless you had the addition of activated carbon, in which case this approach is not quite as correct. So here's a comparison of what it actually looks like. This is ex situ and in situ comparison. The left-hand side are two figures from the Lower Duwamish River in Washington. Those were the ex situ results are shown in the black circles, black squares and the continuous line. And the left-hand side, you see a dotted line and open circles. So the ex situ gives you the maximum concentration, but it turns out in the Lower Duwamish River and the upriver section, PCB18, was actually the in situ measurements were lower because there was sufficient bioflushing of the pore water. So equilibrium was never fully established. So the in situ here gave a much better impression of the results than the ex situ. In the mid-river section, which is the panel B on the right, you see there's no real difference between the two. So in this case, it wouldn't really matter if you go in situ or ex situ. And on the right-hand side is some of our own data from the Passaic River. And you see in green the in situ sampler that was buried in the sediment. And then the other two are two different thicknesses of polyethylene that we used in the field. And you see basically they agree for all the different PCBs very well. So in this case, in Newark Bay, there isn't enough animals living to actually make a difference to the pore water concentration in the field. And the final slide is very busy, but it's a very nice piece of work that Hugh Yonkers put together with maybe 10 different passive sampling laboratories from around the world. And he was interested in seeing if I give all these mostly academic labs the same sediment, and he shared three with us. There's three different sediments. He shared them, and then he asked us to use our passive sampling approach, derive the pore water concentration, and send them back to him. And that is the top panel, A1, A2, and A3. And you see a line in the middle, and then you see a factor of 10 either way. And so when all these labs participate and send in their numbers, you realize that there was almost a factor of 100 from the lowest to the highest number of pore water concentration for these sediments. So the agreement was certainly not as good as we had hoped. So in the next step, Heal made us follow the same method, and he said you have to use the same partitioning constants, the same K values. And that resulted in panel B. So the P1, B2, B3, so in this case, the variability was cut into half, but it's still not that great agreement. So the next step, Heal made us do all the work, but then we sent the passive samples back to him, and he analyzed them all. And so now some of the question of quality control on the chemical side, on the instrument side, was cut out because he did all the measurements on one instrument. And here there was a marked improvement from panels B to C, so now the variability is much, much reduced. So clearly, passive sampling can be extremely precise if it's done well. And panel D, the last three plots, show that if everything is done in one lab, it gets even better. And then you're looking at a factor of maybe 1.7 from an average value. So passive sampling is very powerful. If the QA QC is done well, you can get excellent numbers. All right, I should talk about limitations. Certainly, the field deployments of getting the samplers deployed, get them stuck in the sediment in the correct manner, and getting them back out is somewhat intensive in labor and cost. The time factor is such that because diffusion is a slow process in these sediments, we're looking at weeks of deployment time. But of course, typically the contaminated sites we are concerned with have been contaminated for a long time, so a few weeks more or less shouldn't really make a big difference. The passives don't really address the heterogeneity of sediments, just something you have to be aware of, and of course that depends on your site models and what your sampling strategy is, how to address that. We'll certainly have to include performance reference compounds, use some diffusion model to interpret the data, but as I showed, there's guidance documents, there's a graphical user interface that is available that you can download for free and use that. And the last point is just to point out, there's been a strong focus on involving commercial laboratories to make sure that the knowledge and the tools from the academic world are passed on. And so now a lot of commercial laboratories offer passive sampling with PFCs and the calculations, so it is possible to rely on them to get the numbers right. All right, now comes the question that I never knew the answer to. Knowing all this great stuff about passives, why wouldn't you use them at your site?
Folks, go ahead and enter your responses, and it looks like we're starting to get a pretty good response here. Looks like there's quite a concern about regulatory acceptance. Seems to be taking the lead.
Always good to blame the others.
So, Rainer, based on what we're seeing here, there's not much of an issue with cost compared to some of the issues related to deployment, time and resources, and how to interpret the data. Can you respond to some of those?
Sure. No, I mean, I think overall it's great that there's so much experience with passive sampling. Time and resource is certainly an issue. We ourselves just struggled with finding an appropriate diver for some of our work and got delayed because of it. And there are certainly efforts underway to make some of these passives deployable without passives, and some of the commercial laboratories have those tools so that you can deploy them without needing to have divers, for example. I mean, the regulatory acceptance, I think you can make the case that from the passive you can basically predict a tissue-based concentration, which might be a relevant metric for some of the cleanup goals you have. So I think that is possible, certainly at the benthic level. The food web has a little bit of complexity, but I'll let others. I think a key point is, of course, how to interpret the data is you've got to turn it back to some other concentration than a passive-based concentration or a pore water. And I think ideally you would say this is the equivalent lipid-based concentration. Hopefully you can use that to convince whoever is involved that that's a useful number to observe the effectiveness of remediation.
So along those lines, one of our participants was asking about the availability of partition coefficients for PE and SPME for contaminants. Other than PCBs and PAHs, what other partitioning coefficients are available for passive samplers, and where would one go to find this information?
Great question. I think PCBs, PAHs, and DDTs are the best researched, so that they're widely published. I showed a few slides earlier, three citations that cover a lot of them. There are some other contaminants for which there is not as extensive, but there's certainly data that would support the use of them for dioxins, PBDEs, and some of a wider range of legacy organochlorine pesticides. I think those are the best covered by passive sampling.
All right. Thanks. Just a reminder to everyone, later on in this sediment series, I believe on November 20th, we have another speaker or two that will be talking in pretty good detail, following on to what Rainer's introduced here, and talking more about these passive samplers and some of the details of incorporating passive sampler data into interpretations. We do have a couple of specific questions about compounds of interest. It looks like, you know, we've had a lot of concern about the polyfluorinated substances recently. Rainer, do you have any experience with the use of these samplers with PFAS and what labs or commercial opportunities there are for folks to go and try to test these at their sediment sites?
Sure. Funny, I was just at a startup meeting where they're going to fund, I think, three or four or five of us to develop a wider range of passive sampling tools for PFAS. Right now, there's the POCUS from USGS is available, and beyond that, there is not very much on the market. So startup is aware of that lack and is funding several efforts to develop different tools to have available for PFAS, but the typical classical passive samplers just do not work for PFAS.
That's helpful to understand. And on a related subject, methylmercury is always a big issue with these sediment sites, especially around mining sites. Are there labs or facilities that you know of who are developing methylmercury passive sample diffusion samplers?
I think that will be one of the future webinars we'll have. Upal Ghosh, who I know has been working on embedding some nice solvents into passive sampling matrices to have that tool available. So I think it's in the works. It's probably still on the academic side at this point.
Okay. And then under the limitations, could you speak briefly to any interferences that might be associated with collecting and using this data, that is field interferences from other materials or site conditions?
And typically speaking, because the passive sampler does the enrichment in the field but is limiting to only compounds that can diffuse, it's much cleaner an extract than sediment or biota that you would otherwise use. So in that way, it's better. I remember some of the earlier days we collaborated with EPN. I think there was an ECD use, and we had some interference with our PRCs because the signal of them was pretty high and was swamping some of the other details. So depending on your analytical instrument, you might have to be careful which PRCs you use, but if you use a MS-based approach, that shouldn't normally be a problem.
Okay. And then one other question. One of the participants asked about biofouling. And do you see biofouling on these samplers, and does it affect the PRCs as well as the contaminants of concern that you're looking at?
Yeah, it's a great question. Biofouling is always a concern. It's more of a concern if we can place samplers in the water column, particularly in nutrient-rich waters. I mean, poor water is not as much of a concern, and beautifully the use of the PRCs really corrects if there was a significant biofouling, because that will also slow down the release of the PRCs out of the sampler into the environment, and of course it slows down the uptake. So the PRCs luckily correct for any of these disturbances.
All right, thank you. Actually, we have one final question for you before we get back to the others. So we had a number of folks that were interested in more understanding of the application of metals to passive samplers. Are metals commonly used, and what are some of the concerns with passive sampling for metals?
So for metals, there is the diffusive gradients and thin film, the DGT approach. That's the best one I'm aware of, and that has been established for maybe 30 years. It was developed by a group from Lancaster University in the UK, Bill Zauer I forgot the last name. And that works. It's a slightly different approach, but it certainly works, and it was developed for metals in pore water or water columns. So it is possible, and yes, as far as I know, it's a nicely working tool.
Okay. Well, we do have a few minutes left, and I'd like to pose a kind of an integrated question to all three of the presenters who did an excellent job today of presenting materials. So, you know, we started this discussion with the use of models and a general overview of the types of models that can be used and how to go about thinking about models. And then we talked about two different techniques. We talked about ISM and passive samplers. So I pose the question first to the modeling team and then to the other two speakers. How do we integrate, or have you seen the integration of ISM and passive sampling techniques into the models? And then to the others, have you seen your passive sampler data or ISM data used in some of the models that our core experts discussed? I'd like to start with the core team first.
Well, this is Todd Bridges. Maybe I can start for my colleagues and just say I think one of the opportunities that we should, I believe, be taking more advantage of is starting discussions about modeling and actually using modeling very, very early in the project life cycle to inform sampling strategies. Sometimes I think in the past it's been the case that modeling teams have been brought into a project later than ideal and basically presented with data. And that's not optimal. I think one of the powerful uses of modeling is actually to inform strategies for data collection so that we're making the most of, you know, the resources that are available to collect data that are going to be relevant for use in models as decision tools later in the project.
All right, thanks. What about the ISM team? Have you seen your TU data used in models?
Yeah, we have, and we've seen it on the other side where the data was used to inform modeling for remedial strategies. We've seen it also used to help inform the placement and location of the decision units. We didn't really bring up these examples in our presentation because they are examples where, you know, we have a sensitive client that's, you know, not interested in having us share that information at this time. But we have utilized models on both sides.
Okay. And Rainer, how about passive sampling? Have you seen this passive sampling data used to either build or inform or improve models?
I'm not sure I can give you a good answer. I know it's been used on some trial remediation approach, particularly where novel remediation tools have been tried, and I think then passive have become very useful, but I'm not sure on the bigger scale.
Okay. Well, I do want to respect everyone's time commitments here. It is time for our webinar to end. I personally want to thank the speakers who did an outstanding job and commend the participants for joining us. I think Gene has a few final words to say about this presentation series. Gene?
I do. Thank you so very much. I want to echo those thanks for the over 400 individuals who were able to join us from around the world for today's live broadcast, and remind everyone that this is session number one in a four-part webinar series. We'll be carrying on with session number two, where the topic will be risk assessment, on Wednesday, October 30th. So if you haven't registered for the other events in the series, I strongly encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network website, or cluin.org, where you can sign up for the rest in the series. I'll also remind everybody that we have a lot of technical resources available for hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. We even have an issue area dedicated specifically to sediment issues. You may want to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month and advertises free online training opportunities like today's session. Now, for those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, those are already posted on the seminar resources or links page. If you follow the links that you should see on the middle right under related URLs, you can scroll through that list. A number of the documents that were highlighted by our presenters have already been linked in there as well. Simply scroll to the link of interest, click it to select it, and then press the Browse To button to open it. I also pasted a few links directly into the Q&A window for those of you who may be on mobile devices if it's easier to access that way. Contact information for our presenters is also available on the seminar homepage, and I'll also ask each of you to just take a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's live delivery. Now, one of the key questions that we've added to that feedback form is if there are research needs or questions that you're looking for EPA to address. So you'll have additional opportunities there. Again, since this is an opportunity to simulate a workshop online, we have the chance to collect information and get your input that you may have shared in an open panel discussion through that online feedback form. So I encourage you to review that form and share your thoughts with us. Now, if a number of you shared together in a common room, please know that each person can fill out that feedback form on their own, whether you registered individually or joined under somebody else's spot. Common requests are certificates. For those of you looking for participation certificates, you'll get one as soon as you fill out the feedback form and submit the form back in. I will caution you, in order to get the certificate, you have to check the box at the bottom of the form to certify you are here for the whole thing and make sure your email address is entered correctly. As soon as you send that in, checking that box with your email address, you'll then be able to print out or save a certificate, again, regardless whether or not you registered on your own or joined with someone else in a group. For those of you looking for CLP credits, we do have information available. Almost everything you would need on that request form is available on the seminar homepage, including the title, description, format, date. You can request a certain number of CLP points for today's session, and we often find that people are able to get credit for these seminars if they download the participation certificate as well as copies of the registration materials or presentation content and include that with their certificate to verify their attendance. And so with that, again, I want to thank everybody for joining us. I want to thank our presenters for taking time to share their expertise. I want to thank our organizers for helping to pull everything together. And all of you who are able to take time out of your busy schedules, we hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you'll be with us as we carry on with the session, session number 2 on October 30th. As soon as the archive is available for today's session, you will automatically get an email. Please share that information with others so that we can help share this information with our colleagues. So we'll go ahead and formally conclude.